Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Monday afternoon. Still under the weather, but I'm gonna try to do the Moscato podcast to finish up and make this part two of what we started last time. And hopefully, my body will hold out. I started to do last time when I was looking for who to do the biography on Yehuda Moscato, who's one of the great darshanim. Sort of, as you shall see. And I always have to thank Gideon Miller and now his daughter also, because they helped get all that wonderful material that I used last time, and they're sponsoring today's podcast as well. So thanks for that. And now let's get down to business, as I always say. We're talking about a important Italian rabbi in the 1500s. I've done a lot of Italians, but we haven't dried them all up yet. So, Swarm Chatter is always for draining me a cup to do more Italians. Anyway, here we deal with, how should I put this? I've dealt a lot in the past with famous people in Padua. That's because Padua, which is near Venice, and is part of the territory of Venice, was probably the main Malkum Torah in Italy, and therefore the main center of Yiddishkeit in many ways. But the truth is, there were always two places. There was Padua, and there was another place as well, which didn't have such good mazel, but nevertheless had significant Torah scholarship, as we would call today, and that's Mantua, the Duchy of Mantua. And it's very interesting. If you were in Padua, you were in the Republic of Venice, so you were never invaded. I discussed that. If you're in Mantua, which is part of Milan, you were often invaded. There's actually a war called the War of the Mantuan Succession in the 17th century. And it's part of the Renaissance politics, in which life is not so pushing. Having said that, Mantua is an Italian city in the north. You look on the map, and it's not far from the Venetian territory. And it was ruled by its own rulers, the Dukes of Mantua, the Gonzaga family. They're actually kind of famous. If you know anything about your Renaissance politics, who poisoned who, you know. The Gonzagas. And, you know, Duke this, Duke that, the next Duke, and so forth. For hundreds of years. Until they died out. Then you had the War of the Mantuan Succession. So the reason I'm mentioning this is the Jews, as I've said many times, particularly in the 1400s, in the 1500s, emigrated to Italy, running away from other places, and tried to make a living over there. It was really tough because a lot of anti-Semitism was there. After all, it's the headquarters of the Catholic Church, which was not in a good mood in those days. And the bottom line is, usually most situations, the Jews were compelled to only engage in certain areas of business. And by the time you get to the 1500s and the Counter-Reformation, they really crack down on that stuff. So you can sell old clothes and you make small loans, like a pawnbroker for small loans, nickel and dime stuff. The Goyim, the rich Italians, they kept the big loans because that's where you make money, right? $100,000, so you know, you make some money on it. $1 million, if it's 2%, 3%, 5%, you're making money. If I'm lending you $5, $10, $15, $20, something like that, so, you know, how much is your profit? You get it? But the Goyim didn't want to deal with it, so they used to bring in Jews to do the dirty work. A member of the city council of Venice once said, every city needs, you can't have a city without garbage men and Jews. Why? The garbage men have to take out the garbage, and the Jews have to handle the nickel and dime stuff. You see? So it's not because they like Jews. but they're considered like a certain type of economic garbage man. So it wasn't poshet at all, especially once the Counter-Reformation started, to live in Italy, and I've discussed that. Now, not every place was exactly the same, and for whatever reason, it's too complicated to go into now. Well, I'll just say, for general economic self-interest, the Dukes of Mantua in the 1400 and 1500s were more liberal in the sense that they allowed the Jews to engage in other kinds of business. So if you moved to Mantua and you were allowed in, you could make a living. You could even do well. And you can engage in trade and all that sort of thing. Because not because they were liberal or they liked Jews, but because they needed money for the economy. So nevertheless, having said that, you know, objectively speaking, the Dukes of Mantua were, you know, better to the Jews, even though it was always up and down. There's a whole big book. I've never been able to get that book from Professor Simonson. It's called History of the Jews in the Duchy of Mantua. It was originally Hebrew in 2 volumes and English in 3 volumes. I don't know whatever happened to it. I used to get it from the Hebrew college long ago. And he had all the information in there, Professor Simonson. It's a pity. It was a good book, too. Anyway, the History of the Jews in Mantua. So if you go, you'll see that over the course of, especially in the 1400s and 1500s, as 2 centuries, a relatively large Jewish community was able to build up there relative to Italy. So 1,000 people is a very big community. 1,500, 1,800, 2,000 is a gigantic community. Okay? Not the way we think in America today. And Mantua was that kind of community. And it's has a very rich and interesting history that people don't know usually, because the Jewish life was very dynamic culturally on a number of fronts, right? In a number of ways. I would generally say, to use modern terminology, Torah-wise and perhaps Haskalah-wise and Renaissance-wise. Torah-wise, the Maharik was there, and he started a big yeshiva there, and so did his opponent over there, Messer Leon. And so that means that you came to Mantua, which is not a large town, none of these places are, and you had 2 thriving competing yeshivas with Gedolim running it, who fought with each other naturally. In the end, they were all kicked out of town. That's part of the history of the Maharik and others. But it just goes to show you how pulsating Jewish life was. Because even if you tell me the whole community is 500, 1,000, 1,500 people, but you're not including the yeshiva guys that are there, I have no idea how many they were, but, you know, they're hacking and learning and this and that and the other, and it just gives a frum atmosphere, shall we say, a Torah study atmosphere to life. It's interesting, and Mantua was one of those places. So Padua had an important yeshiva, and Mantua had an important yeshiva. They're not the only places, but they were, in my opinion, I would say they were the main places. So, you know, it's like, I don't know, you know, Lakewood and Baltimore, something like that, you know, whatever, okay? The point is that they both are well. As I said, in Padua, because it was under the Republic of Venice, so you had better law and order, and they weren't invaded because of the cleverness of Venetian diplomacy. Mantua wasn't like that. Nevertheless, it was a, you know, in other words, you had serious Talmidei Chachamim there, even in the small population, and they got in their share of fights with other Talmidei Chachamim, Kedarkam Bakodesh, and Mantua was very interesting in that regard. I wouldn't say De Velt is so familiar with this episode, because generally speaking, Italian stuff is not so well known in the Shi world, generally speaking. But it was in the 15th, 16th century, it was very, very interesting. And our hero will be there in the 16th century, smack in the middle of everything. Now remember, you were under the Duke. And as I told you last time, the Duke might get a mishigas in his head and imprison you and torture you like he did to our hero, who was ready to do a Yarg Vayavar. I mean, it's quite a story. But, you know, generally speaking, life was more stable. There was also Haskalah there, Italian Haskalah, which means everybody Shomer Shabbos. It's not the Haskalah that you imagine when you hear that term used nowadays. It's the Italian Haskalah, which means not only Gemara, although they did that too, but also Tanakh, diktuk, philosophy, you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay? And then there's the Renaissance, and there's a whole galaxy of those types of people. Just to give you one example, Azari de Rossi was there at the time of our hero. Azari de Rossi wrote that controversial history book, Mori Naya. He's in Mantua, right? It was a Talmud Chacham there. You see? It's not surprising to be in a place like Mantua. And Renaissance-wise, the Italian Renaissance was a cultural effervescence, and you had all kind of human activity, intellectual and artistic activity. One of them is, not the only thing, one of them is music and dance and the theater, as we would say today, TV, you know, excuse me, of the 16th century, 15th, 16th century. And the Duke, of course, always had like his own movie theater, or what would they have at that time, you know, like having plays and whatever. And this whole part of your Western civ, if you ever took any course in college. And Jews were an important part of that. So Italy is the headquarters for classy music. Certainly was in those times. And the Duke had his own orchestra and his choir and his acting troupe. And there were important Jews in it. I know it sounds funny to us. There were important Jews in it. Okay? In fact, there were important Jewish musicians. Whenever they used to write these books about the Jews in the Renaissance, like the Cecil Roth type books, they always loved to talk about this. Make it sound like everything was peachy keen, which I told you the other day it was not. But nevertheless, there are plenty of Jews that, you know, made their parnasa from being part of the Renaissance artistic music, whatever, part in the Duchy of Mantua, which you didn't find elsewhere that I can think of. So in other words, Jewish choirs, highly developed Jewish sense of music. I'm very serious. And our hero, the Yehuda Moscato, if you are a Jewish music freak, I'm not, but, you know, my kids are and others are, you know, if you're really into music, you really want to see his book, in the Fruits of Yehuda, because he's a long first Russia. It's like a discourse on the philosophy of music and all this other kind of stuff, which is strange, except that if you think about it, we usually don't think about it, in Judaism, music is held to be an extremely high zach simply because they had in Beis HaMikdash. No, more than that. How do we describe heaven in Jewish religion? Not literally, of course, I get that. How do you describe heaven? B'kor Zel Zev Yamar Kadosh 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 and all that kind of stuff. In other words, heavenly choirs, like Akdamas, you know, right? And what do you call Osir Shalom Bimro B'Yasir Shalom Malini B'Alkol Yisrael B'Momei, which means that God runs the choir in heaven, and this part of the choir doesn't start up until the other one says it's okay. And, you know, it's musical. That's my point. The angels are presented as having some kind of a choir thing, as having something, a music thing. Now, again, I realize it's not literal, but every effect to use that metaphor shows you. And in the Tanakh, he used the metaphor. So you see, the music is, you can see. I mean, you could just toss it out of the stem of a metaphor in the Veldarine, okay? Or you can say, no, it's very important, the fact that he used music. That's what our hero does. And he lived in Mantua in the middle of 1500s. And the Duke at that time, I told you, was William Guglielmo. And in the time of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. And they were very into sacred music. And so don't be surprised that this rubs off on the Jews. So I'm not familiar with Italian chazanas. I've heard it a little bit here and there. And it didn't sound so great to me. But I know that when it's done right, and, you know, it's a 16th century style, it was considered very chasha once upon a time. So I'm simply saying, you'll find in the Jewish community of Mantua, again, Shomer Shabbos, people having the kinds of activities, professions, avocations, things like that, that you wouldn't expect to see in a front community. But it's Italy, so all bets are off. You know what I'm saying? Now, if they weren't from, see, all right. What makes it so interesting and charming is everybody here is from, right? Now, I'm not saying they're machmirim and all that. They had yesh v'yesh. But nevertheless, this was part of Jewish life. And I'm sure davening and chazanis in Mantua, for example, and other places in Italy, must have been extremely interesting. You know what I'm saying? Because they obviously were very heavily influenced by the Geisha music around them, as we are today, whether you realize it or not. Half the songs you hear from the new Jewish bands are stolen from Geisha tunes. We all know that. And that's what it was. Now, we're dealing, therefore, with a story that takes place in the Duchy of Mantua. Our hero, Yehuda Moscato, Yehuda Aryeh, his Italian name is Leon, Leone. You see that in all the documents, right? So, Leo is a lion, you know. So, anyway, he was born not in Mantua, but in the Papal States. Now, I've said 1,000 times, Italy was divided in those centuries into 3 parts. In fact, if you're interested, just Google, you know, Italy in 1500 or something like that. I remember there's a color map of 1496 or something to that effect, right? 1 second. Here, I'm looking at a map, you know, a very pretty map of Italy in 1494, which is rough. I mean, it's roughly the same. And you see that the south is all one big thing called the Kingdom of Naples. The middle is called the Papal States, which was ruled by the Rome. And it's like winding like a snake. In other words, it goes from the left side, which is Rome, and then it snakes up the other side of the Italian peninsula. And you used to have a lot of Jewish communities over there. And the king was the Pope. Okay? The king was the Pope. And then north of that, you have like 10, 15 states, really. You have the Duchy of, the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, the Republic of Venice, the Duchy of Milan, the Duchy of Mantua, blah, blah, blah. Now, Jews lived all over these places, not in the south, not in the Kingdom of Naples, because the Spanish took it over and the Spanish brought in the policy of no Jews. They expelled them. But Jews lived in the Papal States until they didn't. So our hero was born in the Papal States, in a little town, which Italy was dotted with. And he was born, I think, in 1532. They found the birth certificate not that long ago. And he was born in 1532, so the Pope at that time was still not so bad. The Popes went banned in the 1550s. So that means when our hero was approximately a late teenager, or 20 years old, actually, 20 years old, something like that, the Popes turned into a bunch of real schmoes, Pius IV, Paul V, etc., and they started really cracking down on the Jews. And they expelled all the Jewish communities in the Papal States except for Rome and Ancona. Ancona, I've talked before, is where they burned the Portuguese Jews, who the earlier Pope had said, you can move there and we won't ask what you did back in Spain. You know, because they had been Catholic, but then they escaped Italy and they came out of the closet of Jewish. Ancona was a port on the other side of Italy, on the Adriatic. And the Papal States needed to trade there with a lot. But nevertheless, the Pope, I think it was Paul V, burned them at the stake. But he didn't burn the Italian Jews and the other Jews. See, that's in Catholic persecution, it all depends on your classification. If you were descended, if you were perceived to being descended from Spanish Portuguese Jews, then it was assumed that your family had converted to Christian. If you're practicing Judaism now, you're a mummer and you're chai misa. But on the other hand, if you're Italian Jew or an Ashkenazic Jew, then your family had never converted, so you're allowed to practice Judaism, subject to all the discrimination laws. That's how life was lived. It was weird. You know what I'm saying? It was weird. So when he's about 20 years old or a little older, the Pope kicks out all the Jews from all those little towns, including his. The only place he could remain was Rome or Ancona. And so his family moves north. Again, if you look at the map, you see it's not that far away to move north, okay? And you can go to, so basically, where he lived and to move to Mantua is roughly equivalent, not exactly, but, you know, roughly equivalent to Baltimore to Lakewood, something like that. Less, really, less. So it's not, you know, not the end of the world. It's not so close, but not the end of the world. That's what he did. So his family relocated because they were expelled. It was a little town they were in. And he lives the rest of his life in Mantua, basically. Now here, he comes as a young man, and he was taking it, clearly, he was a nice person, and he had a natia for learning, and he hooked up, he married a local girl, and he hooked up with a brother-in-law and others. Now, they took him into the chabura, literally. And so here he is, growing up in his 20s, and he lives to be, let's see, from 1530, 1590. He died in his late 50s. So he spent his 20s, I would say, learning in what we call like a shul with his brother-in-law and some other guys, like a small chabura. And you can learn up a lot that way if you're serious, and he was. In addition, there was a real yeshiva there from a famous rabbi that you never heard of, Moshe Provenzali. Maybe I'll do him sometime. And he was like a gadol. And our hero hooked up with him also. And he therefore had like a, like you'd say today, a real yeshiva education. In other words, with an adam gadol. And Moshe Provenzali was one of the gadolim in Italy. He had his share of fights with the others. And during the time he moves there, which is 1550s, first of all, the Pope is really going crazy and kicking everybody out. And the Catholic Church is passing new gezeiras on the Jews right then. And they got to go to the ghettos, and they can't engage in any kind of economic activity. And this, that, and I told you, there was a certain reign of terror. I'll call it a semi-reign of terror. But the Jews had no choice but to keep their, keep their nose down and do the best they can. In Mantua was a little bit better because the Duke didn't enforce all the anti-Jewish laws of the church. But he did some of them. And wasn't pashut. In that crazy environment I'm describing, 1550, 1560s, our hero's 20s, 30s, he mamish throws himself into getting an education. Now, I would really say a Renaissance education, which is most unusual. When you say today somebody's a Renaissance man, that's another way of saying he's good in a lot of different fields. He's a brain surgeon and a physics expert like Einstein, and he can all play baseball like Babe Ruth, And he can sing like, some big singer. He excels in a bunch of different fields. That's when you say somebody's a Renaissance person. In the Renaissance, which is the rebirth, Renaissance means rebirth, of an interest in the secular, which started in Italy. So it was a move away from the medieval model where everything is purely religious, Catholic, into a situation, to a culture in which you say there's room for non-Catholic stuff in there also, a little bit. No, it's Ruba the Ruba is religious, but you can have a little bit of non-religious, secular, not anti-Christian material also. And so there's a revival of interest in the ancients, especially the Greeks and the Romans. And their writings, after all, nobody's going to go back to be worshiping Zeus or anything like that. Not in the 16th century. And there's a revival of interest in the arts, like painting and sculpture and things like that. And, they're not necessarily religious. And the Jews are caught up in this also. Now, there was an interest in science. I can tell you right now, the science of the 16th century was all wrong. And, they had all kind of wild and crazy theories. And our hero in his book, talks about a lot of these theories all the time. And it was a semishkite between the old Roman ideas and the new mystical ideas. I'm not going to bore you with, Mithridates and all this stuff. It was an intellectually weird time. Nevertheless, the idea was you acquire wisdom by reading a lot of books. You know what I'm saying? The old model, erudition. And that's what our hero did. I know exactly how he did it. Clearly he had tutors. Maybe his Rebbeim also helped. So on the one hand, he's seriously into Shas and Poskim. No question about it. And since he's Italian, Tanakh, Diktuk, philosophy, all that stuff. Separate from that, he's into, side by side with that, he is super into all the stuff in Greek and Latin. So, and if you look through his sermons or his Kol Yehuda, even the Frumi book,
or in the Kuzari, you got Plato and Aristotle, you got Philo, you got Josephus, you have Galen, Agricola, Pico de Mirandola, you know, who was a Christian Kabbalist, a weirdo, okay? And, you know, Seneca, he likes Seneca a lot. People that the average guy has never even heard of. Quintilian, Cicero. Quintilian and Cicero are very important for our hero because they wrote on rhetoric. I'm talking about the Greeks and the Romans. They wrote on the subject of rhetoric, which, as you know, I've said many times, really interested the Italian Jews. Ad kedikachtet Ramchal. That's the same for Amelisa on rhetoric. And rhetoric is the right way of expressing yourself, especially in pen, but also verbally. The right use of words, writing strategies, speech strategies, using the kind of language that'll get the best effect. Now, it's putting a lot of thought into how you say what you say, okay? And our hero is, obviously, if he's writing a book, he'll become famous for writing the Nefutzos Yehuda, which is a book of sermons, drashos, and is very much in this rhetoric style, which makes it not so easy for the modern reader. Oh my goodness, he's quoting Cicero all the time. And Quintilian, my good, he's got Quintilian in the intro to the Kol Yehuda and the Kuzari, for crying out loud. In Italy, you get weird stuff. Now, at the same time, there's no question by him, the Iker was Shas and Poskin. There's no question about that. And he became a big Talmud Chacham. And he's learning, like I said before, Ramosha Provinciali, even though you never heard of him, he was like one of the, he's like one of the Moshe Feinstein of Italy or something like that. He had the big fights about whether you're allowed to publish the Zohar, which, by the way, got its first real publishing when our hero was there in late 1550s in Mantua. Okay, the Zohar was published in Mantua and nearby in Cremona. I forgot to say, Mantua was a major publishing center of Sfarim. So remember, the whole community is 1,000 or 1,500, but there's a lot of quality types over there. There's real intellectuality. When you went into the shul, you didn't just shoot the bull. I mean, there are some people in the back of shul that do that. But, you know, new manuscripts, new Sfarim being published, controversies. You know how it goes? It was Moshe Provinciali versus the Myron Padua. Myron Padua said he was Litvish. He said, don't publish the Zohar. You see? It's not for the Hamon Am anyway. And Moshe Provinciali said, yeah, you can publish it. You know? And they argued over the get of Cleves of Italy in the 1500s, meaning the big get controversy. You probably never heard of it. Tamari Ventoroso affair. I never did that in podcast. Oh, boy, was that. The fur was flying. So he moved to a place which came from a little town in the Papal States. He moved, you know, again, I'll use the word Lakewood or something like that. You know what I mean? B'nai Brak, something to that effect. The place where stuff was happening, he became a full participant. And over the years, he rose through the ranks. And by the end of his life, I think he was a rav there, the Abbasin. It's not clear, but it seems so. That, you know, I won't bore you with the historian arguments. You know, what's the meaning of Moreno Harav, Rebbe, at that time in Italy, you know, Professor Bonfield says this, and Professor that guy says that. But the point is, he was a player, okay? So, to use modern terminology, he knew how to be Masadar Get. He knew how to take care of an Erev, the Kashrus, and all the rest of it. You understand? So he was a real guy. At the same time, he acquired, not from college, but from tutors, like a very solid liberal arts education, okay? Very solid. So he's a Renaissance man. And the big rabbis in Italy would want to have a very solid secular education to impress their own people, impress the Goyim. You understand? In other words, for the best reasons. You don't want your people to think you don't know nothing. And second of all, you want the Duke and the Goyim and the Catholic Church to have some respect for you. See, if you can quote their own stuff at them, whatever, at least you show you're a person in a yeshiv. They're saying, otherwise you're just a narrow-minded Talmudist who doesn't know Jack. That's how they looked at it. So that's who our guy is. And as I say, he spends his whole life in the city, in that community, and it was one of the most important communities. Now, which, by the way, means that he's not only doing Shas and Poskim, he's also doing Zohar and Nistar. And I'll say it again, if the Zohar was actually published for the first time in Mantua, the Tikkun HaZohar was published in Mantua, then the other one, then it was published again a year later. But the point of the matter is, basically, he's published in Mantua. Think about that if you're a player. People talk about who was the editor, and where was the manuscripts from, and let's see the Girsas, and let's learn this stuff. So with his Rebbe, who again was a Gadol HaDor, he not only did Shas and Poskim, he did Zohar and Nistar and things like that. So he's mamash a Renaissance guy, that he's erudite in 100 fields. You get it? He's erudite in 100 fields. And he knows, the Greek history, the Roman history, the literature, the mushals, the tales, and they're scattered through all of his writings. It's interesting. You understand? He knows the Aesop stuff and the other stuff as well. How does he have this? He has that story, I think, from, who was it again? It wasn't Quintilian. It was the other guy. About this guy who rescued a lion, and the lion was being choked by a snake, and he killed the snake, and the lion was so grateful to him that he followed the guy, like, for the rest of his life. And when the guy left to go back to Rome, the lion went on with him on the boat. But then when he saw that there wouldn't be enough food on the boat, the lion jumped over and gave up his life, self-sacrifice to the guy. You know, all kinds of stories you get like that from the Greek and Roman writings. You have no idea how rich the Greek and Roman material is, especially the Greek. But really, you know, you get to Ovid and, you know, Seneca and these other guys. Oh, boy. So he had, like we would say today, the equivalent of a PhD or two or three. Now, again, he didn't go to university. The other guys went to university, generally speaking. That's because they were interested in getting a professional degree as a doctor, as an MD. He didn't. Okay, he didn't. But he clearly, as best as I can tell, was pashut fascinated by Limudei Chol. Now, how do you square the circle if you're a frum Jew, a really frum Jew, in Italy in 16th century, and you see all this chachma by the Goyim? Because it was a time of an explosion of knowledge and science and art. I mean, the Italian Renaissance. It's Leonardo da Vinci. It's Michelangelo. It's all these guys. Galileo, you know. I mean, it really was impressive. So you can be just a chanyak and say, I guess, you know, there's more value in one dot on an I in the, you know, Rashi than the whole, you know, other stuff put together. I get that, but it sounds stupid. You know what I'm saying? Now, what do you call it? If you take it seriously and you really are from it, what's from? How do you deal with this? He deals with it the same way. So I'll tell you how he dealt with it. It's one way. And that is, it's really all stolen from us. The Rambam writes like that also in Kiddush HaChodesh. You remember this? The Rambam says, where did we get, how in the old days did we get astronomical knowledge to run a successful lunar calendar? Hold on one second. I just looked in the Rambam over here. I know he has a mimer, he has a separate essay on Kiddush HaChodesh, but in regular Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, in chapter 17, he says, "Mnei Gorin Hechneda Dabmeil Advarim Haraya Kol Dabar Hi Chachmas Atkufas Egematris Shechibu Bo Chachme Yavon Sfarm Harbe Vehem Nimtzim Achshav Yedei Chachamim." The most astronomical knowledge comes from the books written by the Greeks, astronomers which were around. But the old Hebrew books that must have existed long ago, when the Bnei Yisachar were doing, you know, doing the Bina Elitim, so that's not a loigil, if not a rishas. In other words, the idea is that Judaism today is truncated in many ways. It's part of the goals. You don't have a Beis Hamikdash, then Eretz Yisrael, you don't have Nevuah, etc., etc. And we've lost our special excellence where we used to lead the world in Limudei Chol. Hear what I said in the Mudicho, besides the Mudikosh. And since we forgot it, so we don't have any more. But the Goyim, this is how the Rambam puts it. But the Goyim, stole our clothes or something like that. And whatever great stuff they have was originally from the Jews. If you do it that way, if you go for that, they basically say like this. Don't be astonished that the Renaissance and the Italians are producing this, that, and the other. It's all really Jewish stuff. It's just that, Nebuch, because of the Arichas HaGolus and all the rest of it, so we don't remember it anymore. You find that with him a lot of times in his books. That he talks in that language. It's all originally Jewish stuff. Consequently, if I include in my sermon or my drasha, a classical source or an idea from a Greek philosopher or something like that, originally it was Jewish, Plato stole it from somebody, from some rabbi, that kind of way of thinking. Cicero stole it from some rabbi. Hear about it. And we lost all this stuff, which is just an interesting idea because it's got to be right to some degree. In other words, in the ancient kingdom of Israel, by Thracian, by Shani period, they had books and stuff like that. I'm not saying of Torah knowledge, but you had to have books of other stuff, and we have no record of it today, except the tiny bit that survived in the Apocrypha and places like that. It's an interesting concept. So, that's his way, that's Moscato's way of sort of justifying an interest in Limunicol in wider European culture, as we say it's in Western Civ, art, in all of its forms, plastic and otherwise, especially concept like music and whatever. In old days we had a base of English, we had choirs, they had special forms of music. Besides the Ruach HaKodesh aspect, David and Melch and all those guys had some Gewaltige music stuff, and music can be reduced to scientific principles. Again, I don't understand, it always never attracted me, the different tonalities and all that sort of thing. But if anybody's listening to this and some aren't, or is super into music and all the rest of it, really speaks to them, you want to check out his first sermon in the Futsis Yehuda, which is probably online somewhere. Alehi Goyam B'chinor. That's how he calls it. And so here we have somebody that spent his life as a rabbi and a Talmud Chacham and an intellectual in the Jewish community in Mantua until he died. As we saw the other day, turns out in the last years of his life, he got mixed up as collateral damage in some shtick with that stupid Duke who put him in jail and tortured him and all the rest of it. And he died a few years later. But, other than that, it was like that, that kind of life. The time he was in Mantua, if my memory serves me correctly, I don't think there were any wars there because the Habsburgs had seized control of that part of Italy and they kept it through the lifetime of our hero. So it was Charles V and then his son Philip II. They were the rulers over there and, let's put it this way, they imposed a certain Pax Austriaca, a certain peace. So from the point of view of civilians, that's good. There weren't any armies marching around destroying places and things like that. Okay. Now, clearly, our hero did not write, let's put it this way, Chidushim, Shals and Chib. There are a few Shals and Chibs from here and there, because if you're in the rabbi business, you understand? If you're in the rabbi business, you will come across halachi questions. And sometimes you have to give your opinion. And especially in Italy, you're expected to be able to know how to write a tshuva. So, that's just interesting. The bottom line is that our guy, didn't put his main emphasis in that. It doesn't seem that way. You can tell who people are sometimes by what they publish. Not necessarily, but I think here he is. What he did do was clearly put a lot of time and effort into publishing this series of essays, which he says were sermons. Drushes. What were drushes like in the 16th century? Vesachnisht. We don't have any clear knowledge. We do know that there did appear
a series of very famous darshanim in a very polished style in Italy, starting with our hero. I mean, who are the chashuba darshanim in the history of darshanis in the history of Klal Yisrael? It's Moscato, it's Azaria Figo, it's Yehuda Aryeh Leon and Modena. You know, those three. There's some others, Ishmael Yehuda Katzenallenbogen. I'm talking about books that were published of drashos. And the idea is they're very high-minded. They're written in a very fancy style. All in Hebrew. And very much trying to adhere to the principles of rhetoric, which you find already in Cicero in these places. So you don't just get up, like you call a guy in Chalsha, stand up and say, but there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. In fact, there's a the Romans, Cicero, had mamash a formal structure. You always start with an exordium, as we would say today, with an introduction. You tell the people what you're going to do. You know, they tell you in college, run a successful essay, write at the beginning essay, this is what I intend to do, then do it, and then when you finish, say, this is what I've done. Yeah. So that's a dumbed-down version of, you know, the old, you know what I'm talking about, the old rhetoric stuff from Cicero. First the exordium, then the proposition, then the analysis, and then the conclusion. You know, that stuff. So he really did it. Okay? Now, it's very from Sefer, collection of drushes. But on the other hand, it's very heavily peppered with secular references. But he always does it in such a way in service of the from cause. So he's like Varfing, you understand? Let me put it this way. Towards the end of his life, especially after his relief from prison, I think that must have had a lot to do with it. He collected 52, that's one per year, one for 52 weeks of the year. 52, I'll call them sermons. They're more like essays. And he published them under the name Nefutzot Yehuda. Nefutzot Yehuda. First of all, Klal Yisrael is Nefutzot Yehuda. No, they're scattered all over the place, sadly, in the Gaulis. So, you know, it's addressed to them. I think that's what he wrote. And second of all, his name is Yehuda. Okay? Now, this is the first of the classic Drush Sforum that came out in Italy. And the others, each one did it differently. Of the three that I mentioned, or the four that I mentioned, actually, between Katzenallenbogen and Azaria Figo and Moscato and Leone Modena, for the one that really took off more than anyone else is Azaria Figo. The Bina Litzim is even being reprinted now. In fact, I saw before Yontif, what was it? Before Rosh Hashanah, and last year before Shabbos HaGadol, that they even published fancy new kinds of snippets from the Bina Litzim. And that's because Azaria Figo is very frumt, and doesn't quote, very rarely quotes Geisha stuff. And it's like Dvar Torahs, if you know his style. I did him long ago, so you can go look it up. And it's a very good cheater book. So the Bina Litzim from Azaria Figo was reprinted 50 times before the 20th century, before the Second World War. 50 times. And it's been reprinted with new printing since then also. Like I say, they're just coming out with stuff now. It's usable. Now, the Moscato, the Nefutzot Yehuda, isn't written that way. It's very frum, but first of all, it's very, very stately style and very fancy schmancy Hebrew. He takes melitza and puts on steroids. That's what he liked to do. The effect is very nice, but they're long, and so you can get bored unless you hold cup all the way through as you read it. And I've always wondered, not just me, where do you get an audience to listen to something like that, right? I mean, if you have a sermon that goes over 20 pages, how long did it take to deliver? And where are you going to find an audience for that? So I'm now raising questions about the history of homiletics in Drush and Klal Yisrael. I mean, did the guy speak like we do now before Musaf on Shabbos morning? Can't go for a couple hours then. Did he speak when services are over? Sometimes I go out of town, it's gone residence, and they put you in the killer spot. You have to speak after Musaf, before the Kiddush. Right? That's sticking your head in the lion's den. You get it? It's after davening and before the Kiddush. It's got to be that these things were done like on Shabbos afternoon or Yontav afternoon. He's got one for the second day of Shavuos. And you get what I'm saying? In other words, you daven, you go hub, you have your meal, you actually sleep for an hour or two. That's what they used to do, something like that. And then you go to shul for a formal Gettysburg address, you know, for a formal address. And think perhaps of the Shabbos HaGadol style today, although now it's the style of Shabbos HaGadol is always lumdish. I'm talking about the time slot, right? It's the afternoon. There's no captive audience. Whoever wants to be there is there. And if it's Yehuda Moscato giving one of his things, I mean, it's, I imagine this is me talking. There wasn't a big audience, simply because you got to be an egghead and a brainiac to appreciate all the references and define points of style and things like that. You know, the first two are about, you know, looking at the contents, Emunah and Ashkacha Pratis, and the next bunch are about Kutcha Brichu and the Raisa, and the next bunch are about Odom, Nishmoso, Oma Yasev Yechib Zebaba, and then the next one's about Lomdei Torah, and Mavdi Ben Kodesh Lechol. That's an interesting one. He's from, so knows he says, yeah, I know all the secular stuff, but it's garnished. You know, the only way to get real, you know, meaning in life is through Torah. You know, that kind of thing. Mavdim and Kodesh L'chol. And he can talk because he had the education. And then he has on the holidays a little bit. Not the other guy, Figa, was all about the holidays. And this is what this is. And, you know, that sort of thing. Tshuva and Yom HaDin and so on and so forth. The Yisrael Mashiach. The best one, I forget which one. The best one, I think it's Mutzav Sevasecha Tishma Vesiso, is a speech attacking people who make pledges and don't deliver. You know what I mean? Right? publicly vowing to pay stipulated amounts and then recognition of honors and then refusing to make good their promises. So the guy bought Shlishi and he ain't paying, he ain't coughing up. Right? That's not a new phenomenon. You understand? And again, the Hebrew is extremely fancy. So there are such things called historians of Drush. It's actually an interesting subject, at least to me. And it's a certain genre of literature. And the Nefutzot Yehuda is a classic of that. But it's a classic, one of those classics that most people don't study or read. Only a few scholars. As a matter of fact, believe it or not, this guy, Professor Veltri, and the other guy, what was his name, Mileto, they've actually published the whole doggone Nefutzot Yehuda now in English. But it's in a college textbook form, so every volume costs $10,000 or something like that. I don't know, it's crazy amounts of money. For academic books, they charge a lot of money. But, you know, it's Yehuda Moscato, and, you know, they're studying it because they're historians and studying rhetorical styles and Renaissance and things like this. I forget what it's called, but if you go, whoever's interested, maybe your local university library might have it. It's like a bunch of volumes. So I haven't seen them. Where they really, translated the Gansa, Nefutzot Yehuda. Now, a number of years ago, quite a while ago, actually, I saw in the store that they reprinted it now in a fancy, nice format. You know? I mean, I'm going back 30 years, I bet you. Let me see the one I have in front of me. When is this from? Oh, great. Tafotzna. Here. It's the year 2000. Tafshin Salah. Okay, so 24 years. And I don't know who did it and why they did it, but God bless them because it's very nice. Now, it's not Manukkad. Now you're laughing at me, but believe it or not, and I don't know why, you know what is Manukkad? Leon and Modena's drashos? Yeah, I kid you not. The Medaber Yehuda. And also, the drashos of Shmuel Yehuda Katzenelnbogen. I have no idea why somebody put them out with the kudos.
I wish they would have the Futsa Yehuda ben Nekunos. It would be a lot more fun for people like myself. But nevertheless, it's a pretty good job. And, you know, it's clear print and all the rest of it. It wasn't so popular, meaning it was published in the 1500s when he, around the time of his death. And then I remember two or three times in the 1800s, and that's it. And now only recently. Just because what I just told you, the ideas are really good, but you have to do a lot of digging to get through all that and get through all the melitzas to come up with his chidushim, so to speak. And I'm not doing it justice to it because it would take a long time. Here, I'm opening one. Matzah Isha Matzah Tov. Right? He has a whole drush on this. Matzah Isha Matzah Tov. Torah Semes Hoi Befiko Alakika Lekicha Asisha Ogenes Liyazub Asagas Ashlemus Nizera Kodesh Matzah Uponim B'Ner Mitzvah Torah Or. You know, he's got the exordium there, the introduction, that's telling you what the purpose of marriage is and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and he, in the best style, what's the word, allegorizes, you know, everything. Meaning, when you see a strange, first of all, most of it is from Chazals and Psukim, okay? In other words, he does have the Geisha stuff in there, but the majority, great majority, is from Sifri Kodesh. He's got a ton of Chazals and a ton of Psukim. And when you have anything strange, I don't even know if I should say strange. He melitzes it up. And so, you know, I'm just making this up. If Rabbim has a battle with the four kings, that's Abram having a battle with Gullus, because of, you know, four Gulluses, you know, something like that. You see? So in other words, you're taking the idea and sort of building it up and, reifying it. And he's very good at that sort of thing. But you got to sit through a lot, read through a lot to do it. I saw once Professor Edel, who's a big bucky on the Kabbalah stuff. He wrote, he said, he don't believe that the guy ever delivered his speeches. No audience could live through that. He probably just wrote them down. Very base, you know, anything's possible. When you read a Drush Sfarim, you know if that's actually the way the guy gave it. Moreover, it's always written in Hebrew, but the language they spoke was Italian. So you give it in Italian. So when you redid it and you put it down on paper in Hebrew, did they modify it? Did they add to it? Did they touch it up? You know, these are perfectly valid questions for the historian of Drush. All we have is the final product. And the final product is very impressive because I would say, and most would say, most historians would say, he's the first real, you know, sermonizer in the modern sense. Do you get feeling along with it? You know, you read the old stuff from Anatole and the others, very dry and very cerebral and so forth. Our hero here is not cerebral. He is very egg-heady, no question about it. And he is a brainiac. That's who he was. But he tries as much as possible, because of the principles of rhetoric, to make an impression on the people. His idea is to make people firmer. I'm serious. His idea is to get them to keep more mitzvahs. His idea is they should be more proud of being Jewish, which was hard in the Renaissance period because of the persecution by the Counter-Reformation against the Jews in Italy, you know, as we saw in the story last week. So he's always got a very good intention over here, and I'm sure a lot of it's unique to his voice. You know what I'm saying? A lot of times with sermons and drushes, it's, you know, how you say it, and the tone of voice, and the krechs and all the rest of it. And it seems to me, when I ever read his stuff, you can tell that he must have put on the effect, if he delivered it. And it's also possible, by the way, that he delivered to a very select audience. Sometimes he said, I gave this for a certain chabura, a few of them. But most of them, sounds like he gave in the shul. If he gave in the shul, I'll say it again, where do you get an audience like that? Oops. If me, myself, and I, if I got up and gave, a lecture in the shul on Shabbos morning, in some, you know, highly abstract, you know, philosophical topic, I'm going to lose everybody right away. What's the point of that? You know, immediately everybody tunes out. That's the way it goes. So how could he do it? Unless he added significantly when he wrote it down, which is very possible because it's very polished. And, you know, you see, without question, that he puts a lot of thought into the polishing of it. And the result is that he produced a sefer, which became a classic, but it's one of those classics that's not often seen. It's a classic that people hear about, they talk about, but it's not so much around. Like I told you, to the best of my knowledge, what I picked up in the year 2000, this Nefutzos Yehuda, published in Israel, by Mishor, whoever that is. That's the name of the publishing thing, Mishor. Obviously did as a labor of love, but I haven't seen it since. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't 100% go with the yeshivish type mentality, which is, you know, to not include, you know, Cicero or Tertullian or Seneca or something like that. But I'll say it again. He did it in a very firm way, okay? And you don't need to hear anything about him after what I told you last week, what the professor discovered, that he was willing to go Yarg Val Yavar, and he underwent all those tortures. You can't say nothing about him, Rabbi Yehuda Muscato. You understand? I mean, you can't say nothing about him. Oops, that's my machine here. You can't say anything about him because he literally was Moser Nefesh. You understand? And I don't know if he ever recovered from that bout in the jail. You know, when you're stripped down and you're in the cold, I don't even think about it. So he was no question he was a hero. The only thing is, that's part of what he is famous for. So it's a sefer in the Futsot Yehuda. And you can get it, I guess. And I imagine it's online somewhere. You know, it just strikes me it's one of those things that might be there. And it's anybody who can read Hebrew, because otherwise, unless you pay a fortune and get the English, I wonder how it goes. I've never seen it. I wonder how it goes in Hebrew, you know, to what I mean to say is to see it translated into English. It would surprise me. You know, I'm just not sure. I shouldn't say before I saw it, but here I'm looking online. The Futs of Yehuda, just and there's some Hebrew books. You know what I mean, right? It's in Hebrew books. But the Brill, which is the highly expensive academic publisher, they have here Moscato Sermons from Professor Moleto, that guy. Ain't so bad. It's $40 a volume. Yeah, I would have thought it's more. But anyway, is this something that's going to be, you know, out in front and center? Vesech nisht. Because the ILM is always looking for new things, and this is a golden oldie. You could do a lot worse. And if some rabbi's looking for a very good cheater book, but you'd have to spend time, it's dense, okay? If you have the patience to go through the dense, you know, 10, 15 pages, you have some good stuff for Shabbos. I mean, you really do. Take it from me. But I know most people don't do that. Now, that's one thing that he did. The other thing he's famous for is his interesting commentary on the Kuzari, but it's very late now, so I'll save that for next time.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.